Yeah, so this is the last time I'm going to be saying this in 2015. What do you do when life happens? After tonight, you will know the answer to that question for 2015, 2016, and beyond. You go catalytic. I am your host, Cheryl Hirsch-Kramer, thanking you so much for joining us this evening for our final show for 2015. We've done some marvelous shows over the past 4 months. We've got great ones coming up for the new year. We hope that you will join us. And please tell your friends. We love creating this community with you. Thank you for listening, especially during the holiday season. We know you've got places to go and people to see. So thanks for joining us. Tonight, you're going to get a great start for 2016. I'm guessing that when you went through all the presents that Santa brought you last week, you probably did not open a box that said resiliency. And that's what we're going to give you tonight, is the gift of resiliency. Our guest tonight is a favorite of Catalytic Radio. It's Dr. Michael Irving, back for a third time. Dr. Irving is the poster child for resiliency. The man turned 65 years old, ran 5 marathons in 12 weeks. If that's not resiliency, I don't know what is. And he's had a heart attack, he's had a stroke, he's had numerous cardiac surgeries, and he transformed his body, he transformed his life, he's happy, he's healthy, and he's with us this evening. And I'm so glad you chose to join us. How are you tonight, Dr. Irving?
I'm pretty good, Cheryl. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight, and it's a pleasure to be speaking to your audience. I'm really pleased with your developing a radio show along the theme of heart, and in effect, living from the heart to live for the heart. So it's my pleasure to be here with you this evening.
Well, thank you. And I want to tell our audience, if this is okay, that we're talking about resiliency this evening. Now, the last time you were with us, we were talking about managing chronic pain, and you were dealing with sciatica at that point. And now we're a couple of weeks later, we're talking about resiliency, and I understand that you had a death in your immediate family. You heard about this today. So you're in a good place to talk about resiliency, because you're going through it right now. How did you get yourself up for doing the show? Can I ask you some personal questions? How did you get yourself ready for the show? Because I gave you a chance to back out. You chose not to take it.
Yeah, I just put one foot in front of the other, and it helped that we had a huge snowstorm here, and for the first time in my life, I'm looking after my daughter's home while she's in Disney World, and for the first time in my life, I drove a snowplow tractor, which I had no idea how to work or run, and had all kinds of troubles getting the plows up and down and this and that, and forwards and backwards and everything, and so it was a great distraction. And in some ways, when hardship comes along in your life, you just go on and do things. And, you know, there is a sadness. I do have a heaviness in my eyes that I noticed today. And I had a couple of tears after I first heard about Bill's death. But it's having a purpose and a meaning. And I think sharing what I understand about chronic pain and pain management gives me a lot of purpose and meaning. So I think that's what I have to say about coping with grief this afternoon and still doing a radio show.
Well, I very much appreciate you making this a priority. And please thank your beautiful wife, Cheryl, for allowing this to happen. I'm sure she would love to have your company for the next hour. And I appreciate her sharing you with all of us. We appreciate this as well. Now, we're going to talk about developing tools for resiliency. The first question I have to ask you is, you're feeling your feelings, right? You're not denying that you have feelings as you're going to share this with us. How do you handle feeling your feelings while developing the resiliency tools to get through something like this?
The model of resiliency that I work with is that that you have a thought, a belief, that you're going to get through whatever there is. You're going to get through it. And it's not only that you get through it, but that there is some kind of an opportunity or some kind of a lesson that happens with any hardship. Napoleon Hill wrote it, that every adversity has an equal or greater benefit. That any hardship, anything that happens in your life, that you could term as traumatic, in fact has within it a gem that is an opportunity, is a lesson. And one often can't say what that lesson is going to be to begin with. But knowing that there is a lesson, knowing that there is an opportunity, knowing that something, when a door closes, a window opens, helps to build the resiliency. And then the third factor in resiliency is positive thinking and looking on at having a cup that's half full instead of half empty. So the tenements of the three tenements of resiliency that I see are knowing you're going to get through it, looking for the opportunity or lesson, and going forward with positive thinking. The lesson for everybody is going to be different. Nobody can tell you, you know, I would never wish a hardship on to someone. I would never wish an adversity. But when it does come, the hardship and adversity forces you to be deeper, forces you to reach inside of yourself to find some kind of understanding. And frequently, it's the toughest things that force us to look the deepest. And when things are cherry and it's going along fine, you know, sometimes we don't take a look at meaning and purpose in life or other kinds of things that have richer and deeper meaning. And I think adversities lead us to that. And in that way, having that attitude changes how one faces, whether one feels like a victim or downtrodden, or whether one feels like they're ever moving forward in life.
Now, how did you learn to do this? You have not had the easiest of life paths. I remember you telling me that you were an abused child while your mother was pregnant with you. That's not a great way to come into the world. So how did you learn resiliency skills?
Whoops, are we there? We're still on?
I mean...
Hello, Cheryl?
I'm here. I hear you, sweetheart.
Okay, I heard a bunch of tingling sounds. I think having... You know, I did have a lot of adversity when I was young. And one of the things that I learned about adversity is... Are you there, Cheryl?
Yes, I am.
No. Okay. I keep getting the beeping. Maybe some people are trying to call in because of the loss today. What was your question again? I'm sorry. I just got distracted with these calls.
That's okay.
In.
I mentioned that you've had a very difficult life path, and how have you learned these resiliency skills that you're going to share with us tonight?
Yeah. The hardship, it's an odd thing. I work with people who have, I work at Wings Neuro Rehab here in Toronto, and then I have my own business that works with people managing chronic pain, people who are in pain every day for years. And it's very fascinating that when very often people that I see have a brain injury or chronic pain because there has been some kind of an accident, you know, a fire or a fall or a car accident. Something has happened that has left them with an injury that caused pain or even caused a brain injury. And the symptoms, the way in which a person very often confronts an adversity is through their strength, and it's where we are strongest is where we are wounded. And I got to see that more and more when I would do these three-hour assessments with people trying to figure out what is going to be the treatment that they're going to get with us over the next half a year or a year to overcome, and where are they hurt and where are they harmed. And it's quite fascinating. An interesting analogy is that if somebody were a world-class soccer player and they're off on Sunday and they're in a park with their children and family and there's a child, a baby on a little seat on a bench and a soccer ball was to come in to where the family is without thinking, the soccer player is barefoot because it's a picnic, it's a Sunday, they're barefoot, and they're going to get a broken toe, on the foot that's strongest, because that's what they're going to kick the ball back with. And when we went in, it was so fascinating to see that when people had post-traumatic stress, if somebody's strength was looking after children, the thing that they thought about was the effect that when the trauma was occurring, when the life-death threat was occurring, they were thinking about caring for their children. If somebody were really good at managing money and finances, the thing that they're thinking about when they're at this threshold of life and death is how are their family going to get along without them providing financial support. If somebody's an athlete, very often it's within that framework that they're going through in analyzing or assessing or even trying to make the best of the moment. They try to make the best, or they look at things through where you're strong. So very often it is where you're strong is where you're wounded. It's quite fascinating that the trauma model of the 20th century basically often viewed that wherever you were weak is where you got sort of hurt in a traumatic event. And as I assess people month after month, year after year, repeatedly, I ended up seeing that people were wounded and they were harmed where they were strong. And what that means is that when we go to overcome or try to heal from the adversity, try to heal from our wounds, we're really trying to heal in where we are strong, and it's those very things that we are strong about that are going to motivate us and are going to help us with healing. So if somebody's worried about their kids and they're deeply depressed and they have chronic pain every day and their life's a mess because of their chronic pain and their depression, if I'm trying to get that person to be motivated to pull out of the depression to deal with the chronic pain, I'll ask them to do it for their kids because they're not going to do it for themselves. They're so other-directed. Their heart is so strong in terms of their compassion to others that is both what's causing them to be down because they can't provide for their kids, they can't look after their family, but it's also what will drive them to pull out of that depression or to cope with that chronic pain. And I think one of the places that I saw that for myself, because some of my beatings that I was literally badly beaten as an infant outside the womb and even inside of the womb. My father pretty badly beat my mother up. So I, through life, I found that I would almost go catatonic. I would go sort of withdraw. I would withdraw and curl up. And I always sort of saw that as withdrawing from life or as pulling away or as going inward. And then one day I'm very upset as a grown up. I was very distraught and I was curled into a ball on the floor. And when I'm laying there, I felt the experience of being in the womb. And what I felt was my experience of attempting to heal myself from some of the beatings that my mother and I went through while I was in the womb. And that I wasn't withdrawing, I was going into my healing self. And that some of the reason that I am really good at energy healing, some of the reason that I'm really good at a healer, some of the reason that I have great insight in helping people overcome is because I used those skills before I was even born, and I used them in infancy, and I used them in through much of my very brutal childhood just to get by. And then, in effect, to help others because I had an intuitive sense of what it took for me to get through and get by. And it's quite likely without those traumas that I may have been a good healer, may have been a good therapist or a person with insight. But it's also true that going through those hardships lend me to even be better, or at least gave me some of my skills. We've talked about this before. During cardiac surgery, I went into a white light the near death, the white light of near death. And when I was in that white light, a guide came, and the guide had said to me that the greatest gift your parents gave to you was the severity of the abuse and the extent of their abuse. And what it did is it gave you the depth of your compassion and the breadth of your wisdom. And previous to that, I'd done a lot of therapy and it, you know, come to terms with forgiving my parents. And, you know, there were lots of reasons why they ended up being as cruel as they were. And then there was a part of them that didn't want to be that cruel to each other or to children or to other people that they might have inflicted their cruelty on. But for me, after that experience, when I would reflect on what had happened to me, there was a sense of appreciation. And that was very fascinating. It was actually a little bit difficult to accept, but as it began to percolate, as it began to reflect on it, the whole idea that, in fact, it wasn't just forgiving them, but it was actually appreciating the way in which those things molded me. And I think that that's when I really moved from having a trauma model in psychology to really appreciating the resiliency model of positive psychology that developed in the later part of the 20th century and now in the early part of the 21st century. There's a whole movement that's looking at how we have that having a positive bent on things and even seeing the positive in hardships as opposed to the trauma in hardships is not to deny that there's trauma. I did a lot of crying and a lot of raging to get through some of the hurts that I had. But there's also almost a spiritual, almost a positive quality that some of those experiences have led me to. And it's transformative for me in having that understanding in view. And now when I work with pain clients, chronic pain clients, teaching them a resiliency model and helping them find some kind of purpose and meaning out of the chronic pain, I have people who literally erase or eradicate years of chronic pain by viewing it from a resiliency perspective and rewriting the negative story that they have woven up around the chronic pain. And it's fascinating. You know, that we're 30 years ago, there was a strong view in psychology and psychology treatment that, you know, you could learn to manage post-traumatic stress, but you'd always have the flashbacks. You'd always have it, and you just learned to manage it. And then as a field became more adept, we're erasing for people post-traumatic stress. Now, it doesn't mean that it doesn't come up and you have to manage it here and there in life with some event. But the reality is we now understand that we can go a great distance in undoing post-traumatic stress. And I view that we are almost in the same place with chronic pain that we were with post-traumatic stress disorder 30 years ago. And that is chronic pain, pain that's been there for longer than 3 to 9 months, and pain that gets wrapped up in the story part of the mind. That there's a view that people are, if you've got chronic pain, you got it the rest of your life, and you go to a pain management clinic and you learn to manage the pain. And I'm having success applying the skills that I use with reversing post-traumatic stress. I'm finding that applying those same techniques to the story part of chronic pain, the message part of chronic pain, the belief part of chronic pain, I get people who in literally in a few months of therapy, of work, and it doesn't mean it's just light work. It's a lot of work. But I'm seeing a complete eradication of years of chronic pain, and people are just shocked by it. And it has to do with that we are extraordinarily resilient, and you know, in so many ways, my ability to help people has come out of my own experience and my own experience of needing to be resilient. I've done a lot of training professional training to get a doctorate in psychology, and just in my field, I've done a lot of training, and I've trained a lot of other people. But all of the work that I do has a shadow of depth of understanding and depth of skill, and I'm just amazed at how people transform and move forward, and I get to witness and be beside them in their journey, and I can't ever ignore the fact that those skills are there because of the hardships, and I don't suffer because of the hardships now, and I move forward and face hardships, and you know, I cry like anybody with a difficult time, but I also look at it in another light as well.
I want to thank you for sharing from your heart. Can you hear me, Dr. Irving?
Yeah, I can.
Can you hear me? Okay, great. I really want to thank you for sharing from your heart. I mean, we know each other fairly well. We've known each other for several years now. And there's a level of feeling I'm picking up from you tonight that I've known you've had, and I've heard you express it, but maybe because of what you're going through today, your heart is completely present with us, and I'm very grateful that you've chosen to talk from your heart, to tell us your story, to tell us about your own pain, and how you've managed to use your history to help yourself and help others. Can you give us an idea of how you help people to rewrite their victim stories so they can get that resiliency that we're talking about?
It was very fascinating for me. I worked with my wife, and I both of us worked with profound abuse survivors, for people who had been abused in cults, people who had been abused by multiple perpetrators as a child or had been in child sex rings, people who had been pretty horribly treated when they were young and had post-traumatic stress, had dissociative disorders. And so we worked with that as probably 80-90% of our client population for a couple of decades. And then I took a break from that work, and I spent another decade building a memorial to survivors of child abuse, because I just so often, when I listen to people who'd been through that kind of trauma, that I just, it was like being to war, except they were 6 years old, and the army that was fighting them were their parents or somebody who had access to them on a frequent basis. And so, like a surgeon that works in the battlefield, you get really, really good at surgery. You know, there's a surgeon who is working in Iraq and then comes back and works in Cambridge, they're often really, really highly skilled because of the degree of things that they needed to work with, and how much it changed and varied, the wide variety of conditions that they were confronted with healing in the surgical setting. And I see that working with profound survivors is similar, that those clinicians who it's like working with in the middle of a war to work with with survivors of repeated profound abuse. And so in some ways, we got really good at helping people, but also got to see some aspects of life that was more than therapeutic. You know, it was social, and there was something, and war memorials often gave me a feeling that we make war memorials to help a society heal, to help a group of people that go to war to heal, and to get to help those who not just who died in the war, but those who are affected by the war and had family or, you know, friends that were lost or who looked after the people. That's what the war memorials are for. And I really had that profound experience in front of the Vietnam War Memorial in 1990, and in the fall of 1990 with my son and my wife. And just the idea that this monument changed American society, and for the first time in a number of decades, the left and right were actually able to find some common ground, and it wasn't just the soldiers were healed, but the society was being healed. So I worked on a monument like that for survivors of child abuse, and worked with hundreds of survivors to help them tell their story and to work that into 9,000 pounds worth of bronze. And then, you know, life takes you here and there. And one of the places that life took us, my family, was to my wife getting cancer. And, you know, being an artist, and I've always been an artist as well as a therapist, being an artist, it's a risky life. You make some money, you don't make some money. You do a show, you make enough to get live on for half a year, and then who knows when the next show is going to be that you're going to do well in, or even when you're going to get your next show. So I had to do some serious thinking about about getting a job for the first time in my life. And so I've had a job half-time for about 6 years, and I had that job because of working, because of having to provide some security so my wife wouldn't have stress or as much stress while she was healing from cancer all through her body. And she's doing really well. It's been 7 years now, and she's moving along with that. But what that experience did of having a job is I worked in a clinic for the first time in 30 years, I guess, for the first time without profound abuse survivors, with just survivors of single incident trauma, with people who'd been in a fire, with people who had been through an assault, or people who'd been in a car accident. They had post-traumatic stress or depression, but it was a single incident experience. And in applying the work that I had with profound abuse survivors, applying many of those skills to people who'd been through a few traumatic experiences as an adult that dramatically affected their life, but I was able to, in a very short period of time, see these dramatic changes occur. You know, and the feedback from that, it was a little bit surprising for me. It was very, very rewarding. And I would have people who would say to my supervisor, would come back to the clinic and say that you know, that the 3 hours that they spent with me, which was really an assessment, not a treatment, but it was an assessment, that they experienced more healing than they had in the last 5 years of working with other people. And in many ways, that was a little surprising to me. It was very humbling. There was a sacredness to it. You know, there was a feeling of that I could do something that would have a significant effect on a person in a short period of time. And some of that was recognizing that, you know, I worked as a war surgeon, as a war therapist for I don't know, 20 years, I guess. And in the middle of all of that, there was this feeling of, repeatedly, over and over again, I would just see people make such dramatic changes and get the feedback either directly from the people or from my supervisors or the directors of the clinic about, you know, the feedback that the referring clinician or the referring agency or the person, whatever, it called us and said, whatever this Michael Irving is doing, it's really quite remarkable. And that was the feeling that I have a responsibility and I have a gift to do this with a larger group of people, to not just provide these resources and skills to one-on-one, but to provide it to a larger audience. And those experiences followed this white light experience where I had the in cardiac surgery, I had a near-death experience and went into the white light, and the realization that this was a gift, that it was a gift that I went through these adversities. It was a gift that I had the compassion and the wisdom was, and a gift is something that you don't keep. A gift is only as good as you give it away, as you share it with others. A gift is not something that one owns themselves. A gift is something that makes the life around you, makes the life of others better. And you know, when I you know, some of the young people I work with, also one of the other lovely jobs that I have is working with very, very bright university students and helping them figure out how to manage their ambitions within the academic setting. And I'm always telling them that every one of them, that, you know, the universe gave you a gift to be so bright, and you have a responsibility to do something with that. You can't just let that be. You have to responsibilities to make the best out of your own life, and you also, the universe gave you this, and you kind of got a responsibility to look after other people and to do something for other people. And I'm definitely not as gifted as some of the university students that I work with, because I'm fortunate I get to work with some real genius kids. I'm in awe of some of them. But I do have this gift of being a healer, and I do have a gift of being an artist. And the universe gave that gift to me, and it gave it to me through some hardship. The hardships of both had a dramatic and positive impact on my art, and the hardships have had a dramatic impact on my role as a healer. And I have a responsibility to share that with as many people as possible. And that's where we live in a time where we've got the internet. I mean, our radio show is happening over the internet. We can touch thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, 24/7, every day of the week, some part of the world, some person can be touched by our messages. And so I've gone, you know, here I am, 66 years old, and I'm a full-time student of digital technology, learning how to digitize my information, how to turn it into something that I can share with a large audience of people, the largest audience of people that has ever been existed in the whole history of humanity exists in this period of time. And the funny thing is, just about anybody can do it. You don't have to be a billionaire. You don't have to own a TV station. You don't have to own a stadium, and, you know, where you can bring in your masses. You simply make some really, really good products online and make them accessible to people. And so that's what I'm getting to do now. And I've got a new art form, a new art form of digital technology, and learning how to make that stuff and how to share it. So I got a couple of employees now who are helping me to digitize things, and I'm some days have great successes, and some days try to struggle with trying to understand this code stuff and how to do all of this. And that's how we met, eh, Cheryl? We met through an online training program that was trying to help us be good clinicians by sharing our skills and wares online.
And you took it and run with it, my friend. Before we go back into discussing resiliency, I would love it if you would take a moment to tell people where they can see images of the Child Abuse Monument. As you know, I've been able to see it. I've had the experience, and my handprint is in the monument. You know, for people who want to know what the power of this is, where can they see images of what you've created?
I guess there are two places that people can get my information. The one is that childabusemonument.com. So that's a really easy one to remember, childabusemonument.com. And that website's almost 1,000 pages. So there's all kinds of, if you're a survivor, there's all kinds of things that you can learn about. And there's, you can follow other people's stories and you can see their artwork. For 10 years, I traveled across Canada running workshops with literally hundreds of survivors and thousands of other people in different settings, writing messages. Many of them were sculpted into the outside of the monument with art imagery and writing. And then, like yourself and many others, people did an outline of their hand and wrote a message of healing for themselves or a message of wishing healing for others. And I'm placing those inside of the bronze monument figures. And there's room for like a million pieces of hand. It's like a massive visualization. If you believe in the power of visualization, it's really quite a remarkable visualization about healing oneself and healing others. So that's childabusemonument.com. The other site that I have is Wellness for the Heart. So that's wellnessfortheheart.com. And on that site, right at the middle of the top of that site today and over the next few days, will be an icon button for listeners to this show or people to go to that page. And I'm providing a free audio session on pain management because, you know, part of what we're going to be talking about today was pain management. And some of the messages in the pain management audio can be for managing one's physical pain and transforming that physical pain, and some of it can be for managing your emotional pain and transforming that. So I have all kinds of audios, and if you download that audio, and you'll get a free audio, and then I'll tell you about some other things that I have available. They'll probably get an ebook that'll come along with the audio. There'll be a couple of gifts for the listeners for Catalytic Radio on the website, wellnessfortheheart.com. The other thing is that if you just want to contact me, it's Dr. Michael Irving at wellnessfortheheart.com, or you can find a link to me on any of the web pages. That, you know, my areas that I'm working with a lot now is with pain management, just physical pain management, chronic pain, and just ongoing pain, as well as heart disease. And all of us, to one degree or another, have a dis-ease of the heart, meaning that some way we've lost heart in life. It's very hard not to in our modern society, which takes us away from our inner core self in so many ways. And so my passions now are helping people to live from the heart, and that often involves reversing heart dis-ease, which reverses heart disease, and then also helping people to reverse or to manage chronic pain or to manage pain. And in many, many cases, I'm having extraordinary success in just eradicating chronic pain and I have chronic pain programs for reversing chronic pain. So anybody can go to the website, wellnessfortheheart.com, and find my email and send me an email and tell me what you're coping with or dealing with, and I will try to direct you towards some of the services and programs that I provide. I get a lot of satisfaction out of doing this work. I mean, I'm 66, so I could easily be retired, and I'm working long hours because I get up in the morning and I can't wait for the sun to come up and be able to go out and do some of this work, and it's nice to be in love with life and to have life give so much back.
I can hear it in your voice. You just radiate that exuberance, that joy of living that so many aspire to. So thank you for showing us how to do this. I'd like to ask you, because of all the, it's an interesting time to be alive. The world is not as stable as we used to think that it was. And, you know, one day you're feeling really good, and one day then something happens on the news for people who watch the news, and all of a sudden that stability is shaken. What would you say to people who are having trouble keeping their center throughout the events of the times?
Cancel the newspaper and turn off CNN.
I'm there, baby. I'm right there with you.
I did that about 7 years. My wife used to give me a hard time because I was a newspaper junkie, you know. And that funny thing is, I'd go through the newspaper and I'd be looking for all of these horrible things that had been done to people, and particularly that been done to children or the innocent. And I just got more and more of a sense that I was really looking for. I was trying to find somebody who was rescuing my little boy inside, or I was trying to make sense of the childhood that I went through. All these terrible things that had happened in our home. My mother was a drug dealer, and there were bad stuff that happened. I mean, there were murders and rapes, and there were really, really, really bad people and bad things. And that's what fills the news, eh? And that, when that fills, when we fill ourselves with the news, that's what our heart is filled with. My wife has this saying that what you do 5 minutes before you go to sleep is what you will carry through your sleep through the night. And I used to listen to the news, you know. And if you listen to the news, it's not good news. They don't find good things to cover the news with. They find all these terrible, horrible things. So that's one of the things is to stop looking for the negative. And the flip side of that is to be looking for the positive. Is just to find. It's very, very fascinating. When I work with people who have really deep depression or chronic pain, one of the things that I often get them to see is how accomplished they are at this phenomena. And the phenomena is, what you think is what you feel, and what you feel is what you create. So if what you're thinking is negative, and what you're thinking is bad and terrible and all of that stuff, then what you're going to be feeling is negative and bad and terrible things. And what you're going to create is a negative and terrible and depressed life. And the fascinating thing is that the more depressed somebody is, or the more bad somebody feels in life, the more skilled they are at being able to take and create a feeling out of their thought. That means that what they're thinking, they're feeling, and they're so good at feeling it, and they're so good at thinking it, that they can be deeply, deeply depressed or have very severe chronic pain. Well, what I say to someone like that is, I say, don't stop thinking. Don't stop feeling. You're really skilled at it. You are amazing at how depressed you are. You're really doing a great job of it. And you have the skill to be obnoxiously happy. You have the skill to be obnoxiously pleasant. You can laugh, and you can be so you can feel so good because you have the ability to create a feeling inside of you and for that feeling to create a reality. So your challenge is not to stop thinking or not to stop feeling, but it's to change what it is that you're thinking about. For me, it was canceling the newspaper, you know, turning CNN off, and also saying and repeating positive things, thoughts in my mind. It's really fascinating that when you think that the average person has about 3,000 thoughts a day, and if one is in pain from an injury or something like that, or one is feeling bad about some hardship that's happened in one's life, and if every time you think about going to the car, or you think about cooking dinner, or looking after your kids, or answering the phone, or waking up in the morning, if the thought about your pain from your back injury or your leg injury comes to your mind, and you think badly about your life and all of the miserable things, then in a day, if only 10% of your thoughts have the shadow of pain, that's about 3,000 thoughts. Now, most chronic pain people that I talk to and work with, they'll say, it's a lot more than 10%. They'll say it's 50% or more. I don't have a thought that isn't shadowed by my pain. But if it's only 10%, and that's a really conservative number, in a day, that's 3,000 negative thoughts, 3,000 pain-focused thoughts occur in a day. In a month, that's 90,000 pain-focused thoughts. And in a year, that's 1,060,000 thoughts. And if it's 30% of your thoughts, then it's 3,180,000 thoughts have been pain-focused, miserable, life is rotten kind of thoughts. So it's no wonder that people are deeply depressed or have deep chronic pain when they're pain-focused, when life is miserable. And to reverse that takes a lot of thoughts in the other direction. So you've got to write notes. You've got to do journaling. You've got to find some kind of system that gets to your unconscious mind so that whether you're consciously thinking about it or not, you're thinking positive thoughts. I say that there's no such thing as a happy person. There's no such thing. No, you know, there are tall people. They're tall. You can't do anything about it. If you're tall, you're tall. If you're short, you're short. Now, when I say that to women, they say, well, I can wear high heels. And so, well, maybe that'll change whether you're short or not. But the reality is that there are people who do happy things, and when they're doing happy things, they feel happy. And when that happy thing is done, it's very important from a feeling perspective that if we're touching something that feels really good, it's really important when we let go of that and we put our hand on something that's hot and burning that we do not feel the thing that felt really good, that we feel the burning thing so that we'll remove our hand from what's burning. And so what that means is that we are wired so that if you love chocolate, when you're eating the chocolate, you'll feel good. And if somebody calls you from the airport and they say, I just brought you some Belgian chocolates, the best box in the world, the thought of them bringing that will make you feel good, eating it, and even afterwards thinking about that they were so kind to buy you chocolates will make you feel good. But all of that time that one is feeling good is in reaction to an activity that you're doing or a thought that you're taking. A pleasant thought, a good thought, a pleasant activity, a good thought. So if you want to feel good, you can't just get rid of stress. Once you've gotten rid of all of the stresses and all of the problems in your life, you have to do an activity that makes you feel good. And so you need a list of activities to reduce your stress, and lo and behold, you also need a list of activities that make you feel good. And they have to be both conscious and unconscious, and they have to become habits. And if you want to be a happy person, if you want to be happy in life, you can't expect that somehow you're going to turn on this wire and you're going to be a happy person, or that you'll meet some person and they're a happy person. There's only people who do happy things, who have happy thoughts. And if you want to be happier yourself, have lots of happy thoughts, do lots of happy things. What you think is what you feel, and what you feel is what you create. And your question was, what do we do about, you know, living in this miserable times? it's also a time of greater abundance. There are more people right now working on solving the problems, like good people doing good things to solve good problems, than there were in all of previous history combined. The fascinating thing, you can call it a population explosion. You could call it a problem-solving explosion. We've got all of these great, wonderful people who are trying to make life better. And in fact, they are. Every 2 years, everything that we know about medicine is rediscovered. It's discovered again one more time over. And in 4 years, that's four times. And in 6 years, it's eight times. And in 8 years, it's 16. And in 10 times, it's like 128 times more will be known about medicine than all of history behind. And the same thing about happiness. And the same thing about loving our kids. And the same thing about making good art, or, we're likely going to reach a time less than a decade or two from now where the whole idea of traffic accidents is going to be over. Our cars are going to be smart enough that they keep us from our mind wandering while we're coming up to a stoplight. Most accidents aren't intentional. They're a little bit of distraction of people doing some things they shouldn't be doing. We're going to have cars that are going to correct that. And why? Because we're living at this amazing, amazing, amazing time. And what's fantastic about it is all of these people that are doing good things, lots of them are sticking it on the internet, and any of us can do a Google search and find happiness, can find some advice on how to get over an illness that we have. My wife's amazing Google junkie in terms of she is alive today with a cancer that she was told she wasn't going to live through, and she's alive 7 years later, 7 years past the time that they possibly gave her, because there are so many people figuring out how to help her and help other people meditate, do energy work, use supplements, use medicines, use music and visualizations, in any week there's 30 different kinds of treatments that she's doing. And where did she find those? 30 years ago would have been a lot of work to get there. You can say all kinds of things about how miserable and rotten it is today, and it's just as easily to say much, much, much more about how good it is. And if you want to know what to do about being miserable, which is where your question was, leave the miserable world and find the positive world. And that's not easy, but you can do it. And
that's a great place to start the conversation. That's a great place for us to end, Dr. Irving. And I thank you very, very much for joining us again this evening. Again, his website is wellnessfortheheart.com. Please visit and download your free gifts. They're waiting for you, and they're his gift to help you get off to a great start in 2016. We thank you, as always, for being with us on Catalytic Radio. The first show of 2016, I will be my own guest, talking about nice outcomes to cancer. I'm going to talk about exactly what I did in terms of my own energy to help my dog recover from terminal cancer. The vet gave her 6 weeks to live. Instead, we had 2 more years together. The cancer vanished after a month and never returned. And it was because of what I did and because of the positivity of the community I created. You're not going to want to miss that. So please come join us for the first show of 2016. This is your host, Cheryl Hirsch-Kramer, thanking you so much for joining us tonight, and many blessings to you.